Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In her new book, author and critic Christina Nehring comes out strongly, passionately, in defense of love. She says we've lost touch with romance in our streamlined, battery-powered, go-go 21st century. With a look back at history, she argues that women cannot be both intellectuals and lovers. To be a lover, she says, is a death blow to one's credibility as a thinker. It's time for this to change, she says. It's time to reclaim romance for a new age. This hour, On Point, a vindication of love. You can join the conversation. Have you seen romance fall by the wayside? Are we losing touch with our passion, our emotion? What are you experiencing in your own relationship? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Paris, France, is Christina Nehring. She's a critic and essayist and has written for numerous publications, among them Harper's, The Atlantic, The New York Times Book Review, and The Los Angeles Times. Her new book is A Vindication of Love, Reclaiming Romance for the 21st Century. Christina, nice to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Congratulations on the book. You say in the book that love at the beginning of the 21st century has been diffused and discredited. How so?
Both as a woman, a young woman growing up in Southern California, and as a book critic writing for various magazines, it was and is my impression that love has become a source of embarrassment, particularly for intellectual women, and more largely for our entire culture. We're very good at talking about sex. We're very good about talking even about fertility, about family, about maternity increasingly. What we're very bad at talking about, and also at living and realizing and feeling confident about in our culture, it seems to me, is romantic love.
And why so? Why do we hold back?
I think there are various answers to that question. One has to do with feminism, which I reap the benefits of and I thank from the bottom of my heart, but which also necessarily has had some adverse effects to go along with the extremely positive effects. It's become, as women fought to gain their rights to work and to run for president and to join the military if they like and to become polemicists and essayists such as myself and to assert themselves often against men, they became a little bit anti-man and therefore anti-romance, by and large, or anti-love. And I think it's time that feminism, to some degree, take the final step. I mean, probably I shouldn't ever say final, but just take the step following these other very positive steps. I mean, women have gained the right to do all kinds of things, from get the highest job in the country to decline all jobs and stay proudly home and raise their children. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I think it remains embarrassing for a modern, progressive, enlightened woman to admit that she wants to do is passionately love.
And so what are some examples of that? I mean, give us some modern day examples of a woman who fits that description.
A modern-day example would be several of the women who were interviewed a week ago on NPR radio, in fact. There was a special on hookup culture, In which various young women in their 20s, some in their teens, were interviewed about their relationships. And one woman in particular, but several women really, but one woman in particular said, you know, I'm totally comfortable talking about sex. You can ask me anything you want about my sexual life, but I'm really embarrassed to talk about love. Love is embarrassing. That's the climate that I grew up in. I mean, I'm a little older than her. I'm in my 30s, not my 20s. But that's exactly the campus climate that I know, where if you're a sort of enlightened, progressive woman, sure, you claim the right to have one-night stands. You claim the right to have your pocket vibrator if need be. But it's a little bit, it's painful to admit that you're really sort of just passionately far gone in love with someone. That dates you. That makes you a victim. That makes you vulnerable. That seems in many ways to be the opposite of girl power.
Let me bring a caller into the conversation, because Mary has a question for you, actually on this point. Mary's in Northampton, okay. Massachusetts. Mary, welcome to On Point.
Hi, I love the show, so thank you.
Thank you.
I'm older than you, so I've been
sort
of watching feminism get a really bad name for a really long time, and I believe that there's been a really strong backlash against feminism going on for a really long time. So I don't really think that claiming your right to a one-night stand or being afraid to be vulnerable has anything to do with feminism. I think it has to do with the backlash against feminism. And so I just have to say that I need to understand more clearly how exactly you can say that feminism, I mean, I'm a feminist and I'm not anti-man, but I get kind of tired of saying that, because that's been sort of the cry for like decades. Oh, if you're a feminist, then you're anti-man. I think you've bought that line.
Mary, thank you. Christina, would you respond?
You know, my book is, in fact, not about feminism, even though I started talking about it. I salute and embrace the gifts that feminism has given me. Not the gifts, the rights. But I salute and thank feminism for all of this. And I think, in fact, the most feminist thing that one can do at our particular historical moment is to claim strongly the right not just to work and to fight and to have sex and to have fertility treatments and to be a stay-at-home mom, but also the right to be sentimental and emotional and far gone in love. And I, in fact, only sort of began to make my slow reply to Jane's question. Feminism is one small, in fact, almost microscopic issue in my book. Certainly, there are many, many other things involved with what I really do see as a kind of embarrassment about romantic, passionate love in our culture today. There's also the medicalization of sex, which has many advantages. You know, people found the clitoris, but it also has many disadvantages. There's the consumerist, hedonist push in our culture. There are any number of pushes that, taken together, make it a sign of weakness rather than a sign of strength to strongly love. Let me bring in another point for a moment. I don't come at this only from personal experience. I come at this also as a literary critic. I reviewed a ton of books for Harper's, for the Atlantic Monthly, for the New York Times Book Review. And I guess being a woman and having written about love, I got a lot of biographies of women intellectuals, lots, from Mary Wollstonecraft over Margaret Fuller to Edna St. Vincent Millay to Simone de Beauvoir, etc. And one thing that I noticed across the board in these biographies that were written by men, they were written by women, they were written usually by people who called themselves feminists, sometimes by people who called themselves something else. But across the board, what was true is that the biographer was embarrassed and was apologetic about the love life of the woman intellectual that he or she was describing. So Mary Wollstonecraft, 18th century, maybe the mother of modern feminism. She may have written the Vindication of the Rights of Woman, whose title I play off of in my own title, Vindication of Love. She may be the first women's rights fighter on record, but she loved two men. She, you know, was not always happy about the way her relations were going. She despaired on occasion. She wrote passionate love letters, and virtually every one of the biographers I have read of Mary Wollstonecraft, with maybe one exception, either gloss over, apologize for, minimize, or otherwise try to trivialize and diminish the emotional and love life of this incredibly strong woman. And you take 5,000 intellectual women, and that's consistently the case.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about romantic love in the 21st century. And joined from Paris by Christina Nehring. She's author of the new book, A Vindication of Love, Reclaiming Romance for the 21st Century. Christina, in reading of your biography, I see you live in Paris, Los Angeles, and also Greece with your new baby girl. I'm curious, what are the cultural differences in the way that we look at and approach love and romance country to country? You've been all over the world. You've seen it. How do we fare, and how are we different here in America?
That's a good question. I suppose some of the clichés are true. French people are, by and large, a little bit more proud of their seductive and romantic life than Americans. Americans tend to be a little bit more apologetic. That having been said, I think the similarities are far greater than the differences. In the cultures I know the best, which are the French and the American, I think that the direction is the same. That, unfortunately, I would say, passionate love is taking hits, and the heroic model of love, of romantic love, that I think is the source of so much, to refer back to what you just said a moment ago when you were reintroducing the segment of the program, so much intellectual and creative work is being lost. I mean, romantic love, together with religion, is probably the source of the greatest artistic and intellectual achievement of our culture. And I think that's often forgotten, both in France and in the United States.
And you say both religion and passion, both dwindling in our culture especially.
Yes. Now, I'm not weighing in on religion. I'm very respectful of it myself. I'm not particularly religious. But just objectively, the two great forces behind art historically and largely also behind literature have been religion and passionate love. And for very, very, very different reasons, both seem to me to have become sources of embarrassment. And I'm trying to focus on the romantic love part of that spectrum.
We have a lot of calls, Christina, lined up. Let me
yes.
welcome a few into this conversation. Charleston, Carolina, South Carolina is where Carrie is. Up first, Carrie, welcome to the program. I appreciate you waiting. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thank you for having me. I would just like to say, as a 21-year-old girl and friends with a lot of other people of my generation, that I don't necessarily agree that romantic love has, or passionate love has, become an embarrassment or anything even taboo for us to talk about. I don't see that at all among the people that I know. What I guess I'm predominantly disagreeing with is that Christina's equating passion with romantic love. When I think of romantic love, I think of romance, like the man as the pursuer, and, you know, he has to call, he has to come pick the woman up and open the door for her. And honestly, that to me just kind of emphasizes the differences between men and women and puts a man in a position of power. Like, the ball is always in his court with romantic love. And, I mean, whether or not that's exactly how she's defining it, that's what I think of and think that most people do. And I think that that can stay dead as far as I'm concerned. I would rather be treated as an equal, and like we're saying, now we can openly talk about sex and fertility and, you know, openly communicate in relationships. That's something that has come along with the death of that power balance in the relationship. And I'm happy to have it that way. And still have a lot of passion in my relationship. I don't think that passion has died at all.
Carrie, thank you. Good luck to you. Christina, would you respond?
Carrie, well, I'm thrilled passion hasn't died in your relationship, and it hasn't died in my relationships either. And in fact, I think we're not even having a disagreement at all. Or if we are, it's about how we're using or understanding the way the other person uses the word romance. I don't reclaiming romantic love in the 21st century, I'm not thinking at all of men opening doors for women. I'm thinking of men and women having vital, passionate, full-souled, sometimes reckless relationships in which they put their entire personalities on the line. I'm talking about a kind of courage to love, a kind of daring to love, a kind of almost the opposite of, I guess, what you're thinking about when you think about romance. Because when I heard you describe, you know, calling first and so forth, I thought, of course, immediately of the hit movie and book, He's Just Not That Into You, which, in fact, I turn my face against very strongly because I think it's loaded with garbage, if I may put it so delicately. I utterly disbelieve in its general message that women should sit tight and watch and bat their eyelids and wait for the man to come call or come open the door for them. The sorts of passionate relationships I would like to stand in for are rather the opposite, are relationships in which whatever social role we're playing, women are absolutely as active and as passionate and as full of initiative as men are. And it's actually exactly the opposite of the sort of waiting to call model of romance. Mm. And the people that I discuss in my book, from fictional to historical characters, from Mary Wollstonecraft to Penthesilea, who's a creature of myth who beats the out of Achilles, none of these women sat and waited for a phone call. And that's actually partly why they've been dissed by their biographers, because they were too active and too motivated and too entrepreneurial in their relationships. They dared to do, in fact, in their emotional lives, exactly the same thing as they did in their intellectual and professional lives. They were go-getters. They made the first call, the second call, the third call. They risked things. They risked rejection. Hmm. The sort of he's just not that into you model of love is the reject him before he rejects you model of love.
We hear it. Let me interrupt you to get another call in here.
Yes.
Christina, Michael is on the line from Nashua, New Hampshire. Michael, I appreciate you waiting. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Jane. Hi. I wanted to sort of relate to what the previous viewer said, except sort of from a male perspective.
Good, thank you.
You know, I'm more of in the more liberal state, I guess. I don't know what it's like down there, but I presume that New Hampshire is a bit more liberal. And I feel like in a lot of the women that I've known, sort of they were more upfront about pursuit. You know, that was fine. They could pursue me, I could pursue them. but it was all about sex and not necessarily about love. And that kind of, you know, psychic connection with someone is something that was very difficult, very hard to develop, whereas I feel like, maybe this is just my romanticism, I feel like in the past, the love came first, and then the sex is something that developed. And for me, you know, I like sex, don't get me wrong, but, you know, the love is also very important, and I feel sometimes like I'm just weird, and that I want to have love as well as sex.
Michael, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Lisa. She's on the line from Norwood, New York. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Hello, Jane. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I just wanted to tell you that I totally agree with your guest today. I'm a single mother. I'm 33 years old, and I'm very career-oriented. I work for the Department of Corrections, which is somewhat of a difficult place to show emotion, and I feel that it's definitely changed me. I look back years past as to where, yes, romance was a big thing for me, and now I see it as a weakness.
Hmm. Lisa, thanks so much for the call. Christina, I guess maybe do certain jobs, certain occupations lend themselves to your thesis, perhaps more than others, do you think?
Well, I think we need to speak with your last caller about that. I mean, I would say that working in the Department of Corrections or working in the Department of English at an Ivy League is not as dissimilar as we may think, in fact. I don't think it's particularly any better in an English department than in a corrections department, I'm sorry to say.
You dip into history in your book, The Vindication of Love, to probe the stories of romance in literature, where love affairs defy convention often. What's the clearest example from your research to that point?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that one more time?
I said you dip into history.
What's the clearest example of what?
You dip into history to probe the stories of romance in literature. And I'm curious, what is the clearest example of your thesis in literature from the stories and the works that you have studied where love affairs defy convention often?
Well, it's actually not a single thesis book. What I say in my opening is that I think love, the heroic and adventuresome and full-blooded, risk-taking sort of love needs reclaiming in our time. But after my introduction, what I in fact do is I have a chapter dedicated to a different theme. So I have a chapter that's called Love as Transgression. I have another one called Love as Inequality. I have one called Love as Heroism. So in fact, I can't quite answer that because it's not a sort of single thesis driven book. What I try to
What about examples like Emily Dickinson and that sort of character in our past literary history? How would she fall into your category of love and romance and the need for it or not?
Well, Emily Dickinson, even though she was a 19th century poet who barely left her house, actually had an incredibly passionate existence and in a very unconventional way. Besides being perhaps the greatest American poetry, the greatest American poet ever, she also wrote just incredible love letters and had an incredible mental love life. It's quite possible she died a virgin. It's quite possible that by conventional standards, all of her relationships would be regarded as failures. On the other hand, she had a kind of searingly strong emotional life, which she expressed in letters, reciprocated letters, with various men over the course of her life. I bring her up in my chapter called Love as Absence, which is a chapter in which I actually turn my face against what I consider the cult of easy access that we have today. I have a feeling that today when we think of love, we think of familiarity, we think of being able to call your loved one with a cell phone, with Twitter, etc. We were we're a sort of instant gratification culture, and I discuss Emily Dickinson in the context of the opposite of that, of a sort of separation culture, which I'm by no means idolizing, but I find it intriguing to explore, which is what I do in every one of my chapters. I kind of look at a modern piety, whether it's perfect equality or safe sex, and I explore its alternatives.
Let's go back to the phone. So Amy is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Amy. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thank you. I was actually just going to call and ask about the digital age's effect on romance and passionate love, because we don't take a lot of time for things to develop anymore, and the old-fashioned courtship has kind of gone out the window. I mean, we don't spend a lot of time with a build-up where we might write letters before we even go out on a first date or anything like that, and not to mention the other development, which is the taking of antidepressants and the fear of, you know, being depressed or being down, which if a passionate love fails is what sort of happens. On the flip side is that you freak out a little bit, and that our fear of being hurt or injured in some way also makes it seem like that kind of putting yourself out there isn't right anymore, or that it's somehow masochistic or something like that.
Mm. Mm. Amy, thanks so much for your call. Let's get another one in here before the break. Sally is on the line from Bristol, Connecticut. Sally, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
I'm well. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to say feminism didn't cause that incident. Christina, I don't know, but you seem to expect more from women. Women have to do all the work. Women have to be the ones who are passionately in love. But being in love is a two-way road, you know. Two people have to be passionate about each other. One person cannot give and give and give and keep on being hurt and hurt and hurt. That doesn't work. And also, I'd like to say that let's say in the old days, though, in the olden times, it was love before and then we talk about sex. But right now, what if in the olden days, yeah, they did the love and then the sex came later and the sex was just bad and now they want to talk about the sex first?
Sally, thanks. Thanks so much. She talks about the double standard. Could you speak to that, Sally? I only have about a minute left, Christina.
Yes. In a minute, let me just say I passionately agree with Sally. By no means is my book, in fact, directed toward women. My book is very much directed toward men as well as women. And by no means do I think women should give and give and give and give and men should sort of sit easy. This book is at least as much about men as about women, even though it does take the double standard about women's having to be more apologetic about their love lives than men as a sort of inroad into the topic. But this is a book for men and women, and it tries very hard to inspire, to nudge, to bother, to trouble, to do everything I can to get both sexes to invest, to involve, to fight, to take risks for this heroic kind of love that we are capable of, but that we seem to have forgotten at our historical moments.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about love in the 21st century. From Paris this hour, I'm joined by Christina Nehring, author of the new book, A Vindication of Love, Reclaiming Romance for the 21st Century. Let's go back to the phones. John's first up. He's in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hey, I had a question for your guest.
Okay.
As far as the generational gaps, as like from grandfather to father to son, of instilling the romantic ideals, because when you're in a relationship, I mean, you don't like learn how to be romantic halfway through. You go into it, I believe, with like a preemptive notion of it, and I just want to know what you think about that.
Mm. John, thanks. The generational ideals transferred down. Christina, what do you think?
You know, I'm not as backward looking as it perhaps sounds as though I am. I I probably think that your grandfather also has some reclaiming of romance to do. I'm not defining romance narrowly as handing over flowers or opening doors. I'm defining it in this book as a sort of full-blooded, full-souled, risk-taking investment in the love of another person. And that can take many forms. It can take the form most excessively of a Penthesilea and an Achilles, who love each other so much they bite each other, they almost consume each other. In some versions of the myth, they do consume each other. I mean, literally eat each other up so that there's nothing left. There are a number of excessive models in my book. But just to answer the question here, I'm not sure whether the generational gap is the question for me here. I think you could have as much to teach your grandfather as your grandfather could have to teach you.
Here are a couple of comments from our
backwards
website.
I'm trying
Christina,
to
let
look
me
forward.
Inject here. Michael is writing us to say that all of these people in this conversation are missing out on what love is and how it completes your life. My wife and I are hopelessly romantic, and we are both intellectual professionals. Michael, thanks for the comment. Here's Cecile. She writes, I find men and women have given away any discussion of romantic love to be, quote, real. In my own life, I've seen eyes roll when I've introduced the theme of romance in a discussion about a book. I have been married 19 years and still enjoy romance in my marriage. Cecile, thanks for that. Here's another caller. Nick is on the line. He's in Boston. Nick, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Great to be here.
Thank you.
I wanted to just share sort of my insight and experience. I'm a therapist, and this is something I've seen a few times, and I also share a personal anecdote, if I could. It seems that a lot of this problem, the reason why this is so difficult for many women and men as well, is thinking a little too rigidly and too dichotomously, so that, you know, if I think in a feminist way, I therefore cannot think in other ways. And the personal anecdote I'd like to share is that my wife and I got married last year, and she decided to take my name. And she got a lot of flack for that from friends, from her colleagues, and even from her family. She's a very progressive, feminist-minded, very successful professionally also. And, you know, I sort of thought of that as her finding a way to be flexible enough to say, I'm a feminist and I think this way and I believe these things, and yet I don't feel constrained by that to do a certain thing. And I think that's really the goal of feminism in some ways, is to break down those constraints, which, you know, I think some ways feminism itself can be a little too constraining. So I just really respected her ability to be able to make a decision that for her meant that she could be an independent woman and also make this sort of traditional traditional decision.
Well, thank you very much, Nick. I appreciate your call. Congratulations to you both. Let's get another call from Jen. She's in Boston. Jen, welcome to On Point.
Oh, hi, James.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two points. One, I'm an artist. I'm a mother of three at home. I choose to be at home. Mm-hmm. And I am luckily passionately and happily in love with my husband. And I was so interested in your show. I was thinking about the topic of the feminist issue. However, I was thinking that, you know, feminists really give us the freedom, especially for women, to love who we choose, which I think is a very powerful thing, if we actually have the courage to do it. My other thought is, and question to your guest, is if her book touches on the issue of modernity. It being in the 21st century, my husband and I have a very, we really have to work on keeping the romance and love alive in our marriage. We've been married for 9 years now, and it's busy. You know, we mm-hmm. have three children, we have jobs, we have a mortgage, and in this 21st century life, it's very difficult to remember romance and to keep it alive. And I'm wondering if she points on anything like that in her book.
It's a great point, Jen. Thanks so much. What about it, Christina? Modernity killing off romance?
Well, I completely agree with Jen that having passion be a part, romantic passion be a part of your everyday life is not just a matter of deciding, you know, to go traditional or to have a caveat with feminism. It's not just a matter of will. It's a matter of skill. It's a matter of investment, creativity, imagination. It's probably the hardest thing there is to do, or certainly among the hardest things there are to do. Which is why, in fact, I think these women in biographies, these women on the street should be given credit when they try, and these men to an equal extent as well. My book is not a how-to book. I don't prescribe methods to keep romance alive, though I suppose some of them are implicit in the examples that I discuss. But I absolutely agree with Jen that one of the most imaginative, courageous, and trying activities in our lives is keeping love alive, finding new love, keeping existing love alive. It's a heroic endeavor. It's on the order of running a state and on the order of being a knight that slays a dragon. In fact, those knights in the Middle Ages usually slay the dragons in order to keep romance alive. And I think it should have the esteem that implies.
Let's go back to the phones now. Jasmine is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jasmine, thank you for waiting. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I just had a comment. I'm a graduate student at Harvard here in Cambridge. I just wanted to share among my colleagues, we talk about, you know, our relationships. We talk about love quite often. I don't feel as though we are discouraged or challenged in any way when we bring up love or even romantic love among each other. And also want to say to my husband, if he's listening, I love you, baby. And I'll take my response off air.
So there's Jasmine. She's a Harvard Divinity School student. She disagrees that you can't be intellectual and talk about love. She's very intellectual, so are her friends, and they do all the time. Christina?
Well, power to her. And I am certain that a lot of people do, but the trends in our historical moments are not in that direction. But I absolutely salute and embrace all counterexamples, and I would like us all to be counterexamples.
Here's Scott. He's in Chesapeake, Virginia. Scott, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi. Y'all were talking about the conventional means of romance, and as it is the 21st century, I have a 21st century romantic love story for you.
Okay, we're ready.
I met my wife at a bar on a Sunday night around 10 o'clock. She was with her foul-mouthed friend that she typically would hang out with, and my pickup line was, "What the hell are y'all talking about?" Because it was just ridiculous. And we had intimate relations pretty early on in knowing each other. We went on a vacation to the Caribbean 6 months after knowing each other. And we got married when she was 4 months pregnant. We now have a house together. We have another child. And I am absolutely in love with her. And we have so much respect for each other. And it's just incredible that love can take everything that's wrong and make it right.
Scott, thanks. Thanks so much. Sean is on the line now from Columbia, South Carolina. Sean, welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, well, go ahead.
I was calling because I heard you guys call for university-age students, and this is kind of it's kind of in response to the young lady from Harvard. I go to University of Notre Dame, and I guess, especially as a Catholic, I believe it, you know, it's very important, and I like to hear this, that, you know, that it's important to be intellectual about love because, like any other endeavor in life, it's a very, you know, integral part of who you are. So I think it's important to be intellectual in that regard, as, you know, to everything. But my question as an economics student, my question is more along the lines of, does your guest believe that the current recession might change my generation's views on love and romance? I seem to believe that my generation's kind of caught in this postmodern haze of, you know, the obsession with the anonymous experience.
Sean, thanks. That's a good question. An economics student wondering what the economic impact of our views on love and romance might be. Christine, what do you think? Christina?
Well, I should start by telling Sean that I can't count. So he should take any response I give to that question with a very large grain of salt. That having been said, sure, yes, I believe that perhaps the economic recession can bring us all back to fundamentals. And love is, if nothing else, a fundamental. When you take away from Generation X or Y or Z or whatever the present generation is called, its materialistic goals, then perhaps by force, if not by desire, we will turn to our relationships. So I hope it's true.
Here's another call from Woodstock, Vermont. Robin has been waiting on the line. Go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I wanted to make a statement and kind of a question at the same time. You talk about love, and you said about the artists and all the great paintings and music that have come out of love. But now there's the distinction, like the distinction that was made in the movie Moonstruck, where are you in love with him or do you love him? In love being making you crazy, like, oh, I can't live without this woman, or the passion, mm-hmm. And I guess I don't know, haven't happened to me yet, but it's happening on the other side, but at one point, being in love sometimes can be, even if both people are deeply in love, like my last relationship, where does it start, clouding the line between being in love and codependency?
Hmm. Oh, Robin, thank you. It's a good question. Christina?
The question is, where do we draw the line between love and codependency?
What's the line between being too much in love and codependency?
Well, that's actually an interesting question about which we could probably talk for hours. I think love, like every passionate occupation, including painting and photography and writing and probably politics, is consuming and probably partakes of the obsessional. So that's an infinitely fertile question to which I'm not sure I have the answer. Sure, love can partake of codependency. Also, every other passionate endeavor can partake of obsession. Where to draw the line? I'm not sure one can. I think that love, as well as every other form of genius, as well as every other form of passionate art, and I do consider love an art, walks a tightrope between normality and hypernormality, between obsessiveness and normality, for lack of a better word. So it's an interesting question to which I don't have the answer, but I find it fascinating, and I will think about it, and I hope you do too.
Alice is on the line from Buffalo, New York. Alice, I appreciate you waiting. Welcome.
Thank you, Jane. I was a teenager in the 30s during the Great Depression, and all the songs, the movies, everything was about love, love, love. We sang it, we danced to it. I became so romantic that I didn't really recognize true love when it first came to me. I think we were saturated with too much romance.
Did you recognize it later?
I beg your pardon?
Did you recognize it later?
Well, when I actually, my true love was my teenage high school love, and 9 years later we were married, but I think the effect was that I always thought maybe I'd missed something, those eyes across the crowded room, I felt that we had too much romance given to us, where the opposite extreme is maybe true today.
Alice, thanks so much for the call. Final thought here in our last minute, Christina. What's your personal experience with your professional work? I know you have a one-year-old daughter. It tends to change a lot when it comes to these matters.
Well, I'm a absolutely relentless, passionate romantic, I have to confess, even though I'm now also an absolutely passionate, relentless mother, I have to equally confess. And yes, on an autobiographical note, I spent this entire day in the hospital with my baby daughter, who I dearly, passionately love, and perhaps my next book will be on maternal love. That having been said, I think romantic love has been the source of my greatest joys, my greatest fears, my greatest disasters, and my greatest creative work, and I hope it continues thus.
Christina Nehring, good luck to you and to your little girl. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for an ailing Tom Ashbrook. Hope you feel better, Tom. This is On Point.